This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات ليبلوكم فيما آتاكم إن ربك
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Our headlines: Israeli troops shoot and kill two Palestinians and injure two others in separate incidents in the occupied West Bank. Prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki tells Press TV that the recent deadly crackdown on the Arba'in March in Abuja was not justified. Also, the Russian and Turkish presidents discussed the possible expansion of Moscow's sales of military systems to Ankara, despite U.S. objections. Thank you for joining us. Then with our top story, Israeli forces have fatally shot a young Palestinian woman in occupied Al-Quds. The regime forces claim the woman was hit while trying to stab a soldier near Al-Aqsa Mosque. The victim's identity remains unknown. Separately, a Palestinian man was killed and two others injured after Israeli forces opened fire during their pre-dawn raid in the West Bank town of Orbin. A large crowd of Palestinians attended the funeral of 22-year-old Atla Nasser Zayud just hours after his killing. Israel continues its deadly mayhem in the occupied territories under different pretexts on an almost daily basis. Earlier this week, the regime forces killed at least five Palestinians after raiding several West Bank towns. Now, in order to get more information about that, I'm joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandin. Mona, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us. So Israeli police says the woman had a sharp object and tried to stab police officers. Is that really what happened?
Well, it seems it's the Israeli police narration is that a Palestinian woman arrived at one of the gates inside the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds Bab al-Silsila, exactly. And that she had a knife, and she tried to stab one of the Israeli soldiers there. They opened fire at her, and she was seriously wounded. They left her on the ground, bleeding, and then they searched her. They left her without any allowing anyone to reach her or to help her, and they simply left her to pass away. The initial information is that she's a Palestinian woman, 30-year-old, from the Qabatia town in the occupied West Bank, but up till the moment, the Palestinian Ministry of Health or Palestinian paramedics did not reveal the identity of this Palestinian woman. This is the Israeli media story. As you have mentioned, also another Palestinian was shot dead this morning. Israeli forces raided the village of Burqin, southwest Jenin in the occupied West Bank. They were carrying out an arrest operation in order to detain a number of Palestinians accused by the Israeli forces for being wanted. There had been clashes between the Palestinian youths and Israeli forces. First, a number of Palestinians were wounded and transferred to Palestinian hospitals. And then it was declared that this Palestinian man, Ala Ziyud, affiliated with the Jihad movement, according to the Jihad movement in Jenin. Then the Palestinians immediately took part in funeral procession very early this morning, in fear that the Israeli forces might raid the Palestinian hospital or the village of Burqin, in order to detain his body and not deliver the body of Ziyud to the family, in order to prevent any appropriate funeral procession and appropriate farewell by the family.
Mona, two others were injured in the town of Burqin, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Palestinian paramedics said three Palestinians were wounded. One of them succumbed to his injuries as Ziyud, and we are speaking about two others are still in Palestinian hospital. The Israeli military said they were in the village of Burqin. It's the same village where several days ago the Israeli forces raided, and two Palestinians were shot dead in Burqin as well. 16-year-old was shot dead by the Israeli forces, and they snatched his body. The other Palestinian was seriously wounded and succumbed to his injuries, and immediately funeral procession took place in Jenin. It's the same thing what happened today, in fear of that the Israeli soldiers can raid again the village and detain the body of the Palestinian martyr.
Mona, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay safe and have a nice day. I've been talking to Mona Kandil, our correspondent, joining us out of Ramallah. Prominent Nigerian cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki says the 2014 massacre in the northern city of Zaria was a pre-planned crackdown by the government.
What happened in Zaria in 2014 was a pre-planned crackdown, even though they have no way to justify what they did, except because they are so confused as to say that there was blockage of road.
In an exclusive interview with Press TV, Zakzaki said as many as 1,200 people were killed in the carnage, and many more were injured. The cleric noted that the Zaria massacre was the worst of its kind, but opened the eyes and ears of the people. Zakzaki also said the recent deadly crackdown on the Arba'in March in the capital Abuja was not justified. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki said the people of his country will opt for an Islamic democracy if given the choice.
We want democracy, isn't it? What is the meaning of the democracy? It is a government of the people. I believe that if there will be a plebiscite in this country where people will be asked, which system would you like? Is it the status quo, which is inherited of the British colonials, or the Islamic system? Just cast vote on one of them. I'm sure a majority will choose Islamic system.
Zakzaki said Nigerian authorities are afraid of the influence of the Islamic movement in the country. However, he added, they should have nothing to fear as the people are after a democratic system. While condemning deadly violence, the cleric underlined that the persecution of Muslims in Nigeria started many years ago. Elsewhere in his remarks, Zakzaki stressed that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran had a, quote, tremendous impact on his ideology. He also expressed hope that the oppression of Palestinian people by the Israeli regime will come to an end. Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria have held funeral prayers for one of their eight members killed by the Nigerian security forces. Danjuma Abdullahi has the details of the event in Nigerian capital.
The funeral prayers for one of the 8 members of the Islamic movement killed by the Nigerian security forces was attended by aggrieved members. The movement said the 8 were cut down and killed when security operatives opened fire with live rounds during a peaceful trek of the Arba'in, an annual religious event undertaken by members of the Islamic movement.
They killed about 8 people, which we are sure that now, as they used to do normally, after they kill, they will carry the dead body away. So also the same thing yesterday. They carried away the dead bodies. It is only one of our Muslim brothers by name Shamsuddin Abdurrahman we were able to take away from them.
The Nigerian police have denied that any member was killed during what they described as a provocative trek. Press TV visited a health facility where many injured victims of the attack were receiving treatment from bullet wounds. Members of the Islamic movement have continued to express outrage at the persistent attacks by security forces whenever they come out for religious events.
The security agent in Nigeria, they have been paid. They paid their salary and they provide them with weapons to protect the life and properties of the citizens. But in these days, they are using these weapons to attack the citizens that they are supposed to protect. Our offense to the government of this country is just coming out to show, to practice our religion the way we understand it.
In a statement, Amnesty International has expressed grave concern over the murder of the 8 members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria. It called on the Nigerian authorities to put an end to the deadly crackdown on members of the Islamic movement, which it says has been going on since December 2015. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
The presidents of Russia and Turkey have sat down for talks on regional and mutual issues. They also discussed possible expansion of Moscow's sales of military systems to Ankara, despite U.S. objections. More in this report.
Presidents of Russia and Turkey held their face-to-face talks since the beginning of the pandemic. After the talks, the two leaders confirmed that the mutual ties developed positively despite some problems.
Our negotiations are not always easy, but with a positive final result, our departments have learned compromises that are beneficial to both sides.
Syria was among the main topics of talks between the two leaders. In Syria, Russia serves as the main supporter of the Syrian government, while Turkey backs anti-government groups. Despite this, the two countries have been cooperating in seeking a political solution in the country.
Peace in the Syrian region depends on Turkish-Russian relations. Our joint steps on the Syrian issue are of great importance. The steps we have already taken were correct and cannot be changed.
Last year, Turkey and Russia reached a ceasefire agreement to put an end to war in Syria's Idlib. Turkey is concerned that an escalation of violence in northern Syria may lead to a new influx of refugees across its borders.
The two sides have to make a balanced relation when it comes to Syria, but it is not an easy task amid plots by the US and its allies. For example, the US did not object to the delivery of humanitarian supplies to Syria through the territory controlled by the Syrian troops, and this was done with an attempt to knock Russia and Turkey head on.
The talks between Erdogan and Putin came after U.S. President Joe Biden refused to grant a one-on-one meeting with his Turkish counterpart on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly.
Another pressing issue in Russian-Turkish cooperation is Ankara's purchase of Russian S-400 missile systems. On the eve of his visit to Sochi, Erdogan told reporters that he rejects any foreign pressure regarding this issue and intends to go ahead with his decision to the system. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un has rejected as facade the U.S. offer of talks, saying it is a cover for hostile policy. Kim says U.S. military threats against North Korea have remained in place under the administration of Joe Biden. Kim was reacting to a top U.S. envoy who said North Korea's missile launches are a threat to the region, but they wouldn't stop Washington from pursuing a diplomatic path forward. The North Korean leader also expressed willingness to restore inter-Korean hotlines as of October. Kim said it is up to South Korea to continue standoff or foster new relations. He noted that Pyongyang has no reason to provoke or hurt Seoul. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has met with the U.S. National Security Advisor to reportedly discuss plans to end the war on Yemen. The Saudi media reported that the kingdom's initiatives include a comprehensive ceasefire under U.N. supervision and the opening of Sana'a International Airport for flights to and from selected locations. Saudi Arabia has launched a devastating war and imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen since 2015. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others. It has also plunged the impoverished nation into an economic crisis, triggering food shortages there. The UN has already described the situation in Yemen as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. As the UK Labour leader declares victory over alleged anti-Semitism and the party, left-wing Jewish members are complaining of a new wave of purges taking place to remove Jews from the party. The dispute has opened up a new dispute over anti-Semitism within the already divided opposition party, only this time the finger points at Starmer. Robert Carter reports from Brighton.
As this year's annual UK Labour Party conference comes to an end in Brighton, the row over anti-Semitism has continued to divide the party. The matter came to a head when co-founder of the left-wing Jewish Voice for Labour group was kicked out of the conference over her criticism of the weaponization of anti-Semitism to expel Palestine solidarity.
I was in the conference on Saturday, participating fully, trying to get point of order, for example. And then when I arrived on Sunday morning, the barcode didn't work. And it is sort of automatic that they call the police, which I find fairly bizarre.
By the pillar.
This proud and outspoken Jewish group have a long history of standing up for Palestine and condemning Israel. Under Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, the group enjoyed freedom to operate. But now, under Starmer, the group's members have complained of discrimination against them. Yet, these have been routinely ignored.
We are also called anti-Semitism deniers and sham Jews, which is pretty painful. And we're called worse. Yet the complaints that we have made about really nasty treatment, rude language, including from members who've, in one case, the son of a Holocaust survivor, elderly people, one, for example, recently widowed, with had cancer diagnosis just after she was widowed, lifelong anti-racist campaigner, left South Africa under a white Jewish woman. No duty of care to any of those people, and any complaints that we have made or they have made or we've made collectively, they have been rejected or completely ignored.
At conference, Sir Keir Starmer claims that the party had ended its dark days on anti-Semitism, whilst also welcoming back a pro-Israel MP who quit under Corbyn's reign. Despite the trouble inside conference, fringe events have been held with large turnouts, proving that Starmer's opposition is far from defeated.
Keir Starmer may have thought that after conducting his mass purges of pro-Palestine and left-wing members, that the serious opposition to his leadership might have died down. That is obviously not the case, as we've seen from hard time here on the fringes. Robert Carter, Brighton.
Well, that's your war news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Anxiety or depression was the most common of nine core long COVID symptoms reported among 270,000 people recovering from coronavirus in the United States. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Andrew Gregory and Sally Wheel. The piece is titled COVID, 37% of people have symptoms 6 months after infection. A new study suggests one in three people infected with coronavirus will experience at least one symptom of long COVID. Much of the existing research into the condition, a mixture of symptoms reported by people often months after they were originally ill with COVID-19, has been based either on self-reported symptoms or small studies. Now, researchers at the University of Oxford, the National Institute for Health Research, and the Oxford Health Biomedical Research Center have shed fresh light on the scale of the problem after studying more than 270,000 people recovering from coronavirus in the United States. They found 37% of patients had at least one long COVID symptom diagnosed 3 to 6 months after infection. The most common symptoms were breathing problems, abdominal symptoms, fatigue, pain, and anxiety or depression. the National Institute for Health Research, NIHR academic clinical fellow, Dr. Max Tackett, said, "The results confirm that a significant proportion of people of all ages can be affected by a range of symptoms and difficulties in the 6 months after COVID-19 infection." Dr. Tackett added, "Over one-third of patients were diagnosed with at least one of the long COVID symptoms between 3 and 6 months after their COVID-19 illness." According to the data from the US-based TriNetX Electronic Health Record Network, severity of infection, age, and sex affected the likelihood of long COVID symptoms. The study published in the journal Plus Medicine showed long COVID symptoms were more frequent in those who had been hospitalized, and they were slightly more common in women. Different factors also influenced which of the symptoms people were most likely to experience. For example, older people and men had more breathing difficulties and cognitive problems, whereas young people and women had more headaches, abdominal symptoms, and anxiety or depression. The research found COVID patients admitted to hospital were more likely to suffer cognitive problems like brain fog and fatigue compared with people who did not need to be admitted. People who did not need hospital care were more likely to have headaches than those who needed to be admitted to hospital. The researcher said many patients had more than one long COVID symptom. Dr. Tackett said, "These data complement findings from self-report surveys and show that clinicians are diagnosing patients with these symptoms. We need appropriately configured services to deal with the current and future clinical needs." The study also looked at the same symptoms in people recovering from flu. The study suggests people who get flu can have prolonged symptoms similar to those seen in some patients with long COVID, but lasting symptoms occur to a far lesser extent in those who had influenza. The researchers estimated symptoms linked to long COVID were 50% more common among those who had COVID compared with those who had flu. Professor Amitabha Banerjee, Professor of Clinical Data Science and Honorary Consultant Cardiologist at University College London, who was not involved in the research, said it was a large, well-conducted and thorough study. He said the findings supported the calls that have been made for large-scale rollout of health services for those with long COVID, including those not hospitalized with COVID-19. Professor Banerjee said over half of patients, or 57% of them, had at least one long COVID feature recorded in the 6 months after infection, and one-third, or 37%, in the 90 to 180 days after diagnosis. Professor Amitabha Banerjee stressed the study had limitations, such as the fact it had focused on the 9 symptoms probably most common among those with long COVID. However, because as many as 200 signs of long COVID have previously been suggested, the reported incidence of long COVID was actually likely to be an underestimate. He added that the fact the 9 symptoms were all more common after COVID-19 than for flu was yet another arrow in the quiver against bogus "this is just like flu" claims. Separate research published on Tuesday, 28th of September, found more than 1 in 10 secondary school pupils and over a third of school staff who had COVID-19 in England have suffered ongoing symptoms. According to the study from the Office of National Statistics, the most common symptom reported by staff and school pupils was weakness or tiredness, while staff were more likely to experience shortness of breath than pupils. Overall, the Office for National Statistics estimates that 970,000 people in the United Kingdom are suffering continuing symptoms after a COVID-19 infection. The figures, based on self-reported symptoms, also suggest 384,000 people are still living with symptoms a year after infection. Moreover, in recent months, long COVID has received a great deal of media and public attention. Research has found that as many as one in four of those infected with COVID, perhaps millions of people in the United States alone, suffer from chronic long-term symptoms, including headaches, dizziness, abdominal pain, heart problems, fatigue, anxiety, depression, cognitive impairment, and other conditions. It is a difficult and complex illness, and we must do much more to help those who are struggling with it. At the same time, it is important to realize that rather than being a strange special case, long COVID is probably part of a broader phenomena that affects many more people. In recent years, doctors and researchers have increasingly realized that many of those who survive an illness of any kind or who go through serious physical trauma are at high risk for a range of debilitating and chronic physical, cognitive and mental health symptoms, problems that closely resemble long COVID. Seen in this context, it's not at all surprising that many patients infected with COVID find themselves dealing with an array of persistent health problems. This is not to minimize long COVID in any way, but simply to put it in a broader context. The issue is in part a byproduct of a medical transformation. Over the past half century, as medicine has advanced, clinicians have learned how to save hundreds of thousands of severely ill or injured patients who would have previously died. This is a remarkable accomplishment. But in many cases, survival does not mean complete recovery. Some patients find that their bodies, brains, and psyches continue to bear the scars of what they have gone through. One non-COVID study found that a year after hospitalization, a third of patients with severe respiratory failure or shock had significant cognitive impairment. Another study found that between a quarter and a third of patients who were treated in the intensive care unit had significant and long-lasting symptoms of anxiety, depression, or post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. Researchers have found similar results for survivors of other medical conditions, including cancer, multiple sclerosis, and ALS. Unfortunately, people with long COVID, as well as other chronic post-illness symptoms, often find that the medical establishment doesn't understand their experience and so minimizes or questions it. This is not surprising. Clinicians tend to pay less attention to how patients with severe illness do once they're out of mortal danger or once symptoms extend beyond an arbitrary time frame. Researchers do not yet fully understand the physical causes of these chronic symptoms. It is clear that long COVID and long versions of other illnesses and injuries are not psychosomatic. These conditions have a psychological basis. Among the possible culprits may be persistent dysfunction in inflammatory or immune responses triggered by the initial illness or initial injury. In some cases, the disease or injury may also leave permanent damage, just as someone with a broken leg may end up walking with a limp.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com www.israelnow.org/en. On September 17, 2021, the U.S. defense officials admitted that a drone strike in Kabul that had killed 10 civilians, including 7 children, was a mistake. The Defense Department said the strike was conducted after numerous miscalculations by commanders who wrongly believed an aid worker was carrying explosives in his car. Just 20 days before this statement, the same defense officials defended their decision as a righteous strike. The strike came after days of chaos in Kabul, as thousands of Afghans tried to flee through the airport. It was after the flee of American forces from Afghanistan and the end of the U.S.-led occupation in the impoverished country. The airstrike was the latest of thousands of strikes that the U.S. conducted in Afghanistan during its 2 decades of operation. Raids that sometimes killed civilians and usually were followed by initial or perpetual Pentagon denials. The truth is, the U.S. military was only forced to admit its failure in this strike because of the current global sensitivity towards Afghanistan. If the situation was different, Washington would not admit its fault and would get away with murder, just like all those other times that it launched strikes on civilians and claimed it targeted terrorist positions. Rights organizations say the U.S. drone strike in Kabul could amount to war crimes. This is not something new. The United States has been accused of committing war crimes in Afghanistan on numerous occasions. Since the very beginning of invasion in October 2001, U.S. soldiers and military contractors have been accused of murder, torture, and kidnap. The deliberate targeting of civilians by foreign troops continued to the day they left Afghan soil. One of the most notorious killings is called the Kandahar Massacre. In 2012, a U.S. Army staffer murdered 16 Afghan civilians and wounded 6 others in the Panjawe district. 9 children were among the victims, and some of the corpses were partially burned. Although U.S. officials argued that what happened to those civilians was the act of a single individual, further investigations showed that at least 20 U.S. soldiers were involved in that massacre. In another example, it was revealed that in 2002, the U.S. Army members tortured unarmed Afghan civilians to death in Bagram. The victims were repeatedly chained to the ceiling and beaten, resulting in their deaths. There are hundreds of similar accounts which have gone unpublished, but if investigated, most of them will be categorized as war crimes. U.S. drone strikes are another part of America's vicious legacy in the war-torn country. Since the September 11th attacks, U.S. presidents have adopted drone warfare as a central feature of America's foreign policy.
thousands of Afghans were killed because U.S. military officials thought drone strikes were precise strikes that targeted alleged militants. The number of these strikes were so high that at least one out of two Afghan villagers say it happened to them, and not just once, and the incidents never made the news anywhere outside Afghanistan. For example, last year, in November, a U.S. Reaper drone targeted a group of villagers in the mountainous area of Paktia and killed seven people. American officials said Paktia was under Taliban control and the targets were Talibs. But locals said all the victims were all civilians and one child was among them. An independent investigation into U.S. drone warfare shows that between 2004 and 2020, the U.S. military carried out over 13,000 strikes across Afghanistan, in which over 10,000 Afghans were killed. Nearly 200 children were among the dead. The families of victims of these drone strikes are almost certain that those responsible for the deaths of their loved ones are never going to face justice. In 20 years of occupation, only a few investigations were launched to see if the U.S. military is committing war crimes in Afghanistan. In March 2020, judges of the International Criminal Court, or ICC, gave the ICC prosecutor authority to begin an investigation into possible war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Afghanistan. The probe investigates the alleged murder, imprisonment, torture, and targeting of civilians committed by Afghan government, Taliban, and U.S. forces.
In conclusion, the Appeals Chamber considers it appropriate to amend the appeal decision to the effect that the prosecutor is authorized to commence investigation in relation to alleged crimes committed on the territory of Afghanistan in the period since 1st May 2003, as well as other alleged crimes that have a nexus to the armed conflict in Afghanistan and are sufficiently linked to the situation and were committed on the territory of other state parties in the period since 1st July 2002.
But reports indicate that U.S. drone strikes are not included in the inquiry. Experts say U.S. drone strikes could be seen as violations of international humanitarian law. But that does not make it a war crime. To call the drone strikes a war crime, the investigators must find evidence that those attacks were intentional or sufficiently reckless. Meanwhile, determining recklessness requires a legal analysis in each case of the evidence. Afghanistan is the most drone-bombed country in the world. But it's not just the drone strikes. The U.S. Central Command Combined Air Operations Center says the U.S. Air Force dropped a record 7,423 bombs on Afghanistan. This is more than at any time in the past 10 years. More than 100,000 Afghans have been killed or wounded since 2009, when the UN assistance mission in Afghanistan began documenting casualties. Meanwhile, not even a handful of these deaths have been investigated, and with the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, it's unlikely that anyone will probe what the U.S. has done to Afghans. But reality cannot be forgotten. Each innocent life that's been lost was not a mistake. It was a crime.
In the limelight.
Critics say Britain's Labour leader Keir Starmer has hijacked a recent gathering by getting bogged down in voting issues and losing sight of a focus on policy. We're prepared for you an article written by Toby Helm. The piece is titled Infighting Mars Start of Labour Conference as Starmer and Rayner Clash Over Voting Rules in UK. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. when Angela Rayner, Labour's deputy leader, stood up to huge cheers to address her party's conference on Saturday, 25th of September, the slogan Stronger Future Together was projected on the big screen behind her and all around the vast hall. Before what had been billed as Keir Starmer's defining conference, when he would reveal the real Keir to the nation, the party leader had also spoken recently of the need for togetherness in the party in a 35-page pamphlet spelling out his vision for Britain. Keir Starmer wrote, "In recent decades, the legacy of the 1997 Labour government has become contested to the extent that the party has at times felt like separate families living under one roof. This has been harmful and alienating." But before most delegates had even arrived in Brighton, hopes of Keir Starmer's party hanging together for 4 days by the seaside and focusing on attacking the Tories as they struggled to deal with the threat of fuel shortages and empty shelves in supermarkets had been horribly shattered. Before Angela Rayner's speech, her friends were briefing that she was furious with Keir Starmer. The deputy leader, they said, was enraged that her boss had allowed the start of the annual gathering, potentially the second last before a general election, to be hijacked by an unnecessary row over changes to rules on how future leaders should be elected, to which she was opposed. Angela Rayner had to spend much of Saturday morning, when she should have been preparing for a big conference moment, holed up in an emergency meeting of the National Executive Committee in Brighton's Hilton Hotel, trying to amend Keir Starmer's plans into an acceptable form and forge compromises on other rule changes with the unions. A source said she was against Keir Starmer's main plan, adding, "But she also had to try to broker some deal before the whole party fell apart. She was very cross because she had spent months talking to the unions about the serious economic plans we wanted to launch at the conference, only for them to be buried in the media under coverage of this mess." On Saturday, 25th of September, the centrepiece of Keir Starmer's plan to weaken the role of the 400,000 party members and strengthen that of MPs by returning to the old electoral college system for electing leaders was pulled hours before the gathering opened after the unions ganged up to oppose it. The left saw it as an anti-democratic stitch-up and an attack on individual members who had elected Jeremy Corbyn that was designed to prevent another from his wing of the party ever becoming leader. The conference mood had been set before a single motion had been debated. Not only were the leader and his deputy at odds, the unions were defiant in victory and the media focused on little else. But across the party, from top to bottom, there was disbelief on how the fiasco could have been allowed to happen. Unlike previous leaders, from Neil Kinnock over his battle with the militant tendency to John Smith's fight to deliver one member, one vote, and Tony Blair's confrontation with sections of his party over the rewriting of Clause 4, Keir Starmer had just taken on the left and lost. A senior shadow cabinet member said, "It has been a very, very bad start. The problem is that they just don't listen to advice. Why did they try to introduce these rule changes at all? And why did they then do so before checking first that they could land them? It really is unbelievable." Another senior figure said that Keir Starmer had mentioned the plan only briefly in a meeting of the Shadow Cabinet last Tuesday, 21st of September, and in such a way that many of those present probably didn't clock what he meant, adding, "It is pretty clear that what they were trying to do is to get a win over the left for Keir Starmer, a Kinnock moment. And by doing it so late and quietly, they hoped opposition could not build in time." Another senior source said there was widespread suspicion that Peter Mandelson had had a role in suggesting the idea, something that he denies. The source said there is view that Peter Mandelson was involved, if not directly, then at once or twice removed. Rows between labor leaders and their deputies have happened before. 2 years ago, the opening of the conference was wrecked by a clumsy attempt by Jeremy Corbyn's supporters to abolish the post of deputy leader, then occupied by Tom Watson. Such was the uproar at the way the plot had been hatched in secret that the idea had to be swiftly abandoned, but not before much bad blood had been spilled. On Saturday, 25th of September, senior figures said Keir Starmer's disastrous start was worse than in 2019. One said, "It is difficult to upstage what had happened 2 years ago, but Keir had a very good stab at it, hasn't he?" Another senior source, when asked if the leader could pull the conference back from the brink, was pessimistic. "I really don't think so. His authority is shot." Outside the conference hall, there were cries of "Stop the Purge" and "Starmer out, socialism in." Members of the French Bend desperately tried to sell the rule changes that were in the end agreed, including one that makes it more difficult for local parties to deselect their MPs, as a great success. One shadow minister said despite all the noise, Keir Starmer had made his marks. He had locked out the hard left in MP selections. But privately, even loyalists were in despair. The Brighton gathering had been billed for months by Keir Starmer's team as the moment he would truly define himself in the minds of the electorate, after criticism of his lack of eye-catching policies and Labour's failure to overtake the Tories in the opinion polls, despite successive government crises. Despite all these, moods can change fast. There is still an opportunity for the party to unite behind the set of ideas and policies that will allow delegates to leave Brighton in the coming days in upbeat mood. Conference organisers say Keir Starmer's speech will be packed with announcements. Ed Miliband, the Shadow Business and Energy Secretary, is going to push his foot hard down on the Green New Deal, with bold plans to modernise and green the steel industry in the interest of saving the climate and preserving jobs. Miliband has been making the case in Shadow Cabinet for a President Biden-style stimulus package to decarbonize industry, create jobs in low-carbon industries, and rapidly retrofit homes. There will also be more announcements on security in work and training and education for young people. However, Keir Starmer will wrap up the conference with even more now riding on his speech than before. But speaking out against Keir Starmer's leadership is no longer regarded as shocking, and on the left it has become commonplace. The attention-grabbing policies have yet to be revealed.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you.
Because you are
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special, and I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of Muslim Lady. I hope wherever you are, you're in the best state of health, wealth, and spirituality, blessed with Allah's bounties, and filled with gratitude toward the wonders of life. In the studio with me, as always, I have the honor and privilege of being accompanied by a special guest and a darling sister, Sister Razia Shamini. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you so much for joining us. Throughout these last few episodes, we had sort of like themed topics, like a series of episodes dedicated to certain topics that we could benefit from as Muslim ladies, whether it was the ladies of Ashura, whether it was...
As you call it, Ashura and ladies.
Yeah, exactly, or Ashura and ladies, or the different aspects of the Noble Prophet's life, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that we could learn from as Muslim ladies. And as always, you were creative enough to highlight his beauty routine.
That's very nice of you.
And I really feel that it's super creative because it's trending so much in today's world, but women need to draw inspiration from perhaps a more divine source rather than quote-unquote influencers on Instagram. What you have in store for us is yet another awesome, interesting, intriguing, captivating topic, and it is regarding the women in the life of His Eminence, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And interestingly enough, he dealt with a lot of women. Yeah, and in the most delicate, most considerate, generous way possible, that makes you think, well, how could anyone hurt this man?
And still he got hurt.
So where would you like to start off?
There are so many reasons why we have chosen to talk about the seerah or the conduct of the Noble Prophet regarding women, including his mother, later on his wet nurse. Later on, we move on to his wife, first of all, Lady Khadija, and then the other wives, and then his four daughters. Of course, the historian have dispute over how many daughters the Prophet had, and so on and so. And his wet sisters, aunts, because the Saudi Arabian Peninsula was a very interconnected society where, you know, at some point in history, he met them in the battles, and he fought against their men.
Interesting.
And his treatment of them was very interesting.
Right.
How
right.
he showed, we're going to see how his conduct was. Was he appreciative of them? Did he hold them in esteem? Did he honor them? Or he said that, you know, no. Whatever they are, whoever they are, this is Islam, and I'm going to do this and that to them.
Interesting. This is very interesting. And of course, Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam stands in regard with women in general and how he totally revolutionized a society that condemned women to death upon their existence in this world and thought of them as shame and thought of them as a taint on the family name and the prestige of their tribe.
Because one of the reasons was that once they were defeated in a battle, these women were taken as captives, and so this was kind of considered as somehow shame and, you know,
dishonor to them.
That was perhaps one of the reasons.
But it's like, you know what they say in Persian, that an excuse that's worse than the sin, than the error itself.
Right.
Like, your excuse is that you, okay, I have to bury this girl alive in her infancy because she's going to be taken as captive and tortured and God knows what else. But more of that after a short break, so stay with us.
Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back to Muslim Lady here in the studio. I'm with my darling sister Razia Shamili, and we're talking about the women in the life of His Eminence Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. What was it that you wanted to say before we went for a break, Sister Razia?
A couple of days ago, I went somewhere in the suburbs of a city, and I came across a couple who were living in a farm. And they obviously there, that kind of life entails having dogs to guard the land
for
and
sure,
everything.
Yeah.
And one of their dogs had given birth to 7 puppies. And she was telling me that one of the puppies was extremely weak and darker than the others, like not so much prettier in terms of, like, the other ones were fluffy and they had so much hair. This one was so weak and, you know, it looked as if it was going to die. And then this lady, she said that we would see the mother taking the puppy to somewhere else, putting it in a kind of dig somewhere he had dug, and the dog. And we would